Hey, Bill, how's it going this week?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm drowning in Reverend Wright blog posts. What about you?
So my sense is after Obama's speech on Tuesday, I've seen a split in conservative reaction to this, with some conservative bloggers, other commentators embracing the speech, treating it as a story, calling it brilliant, etc., and other conservative bloggers that are trying to cherry-pick quotes, take them out of context, and try to undermine the objectives of the speech. Is that your sense of it?
Well, if by split you mean 80-20, then sure.
Getting 20 and the more, is pretty impressive, I have to say.
The more recognizable names that are praising the speech aren't really bloggers. The Charles Murray, Peggy Noonan's of the world are kind of more old media. But, you know, your hardcore conservative bloggers, the Hugh Hewitts of the world, Joan at the Corner, Ramesh, everyone else over there, Michelle Malkin, your bigger names in the conservative blogosphere were uniformly unhappy with the speech.
But are they undermined when you have Charles Murray, Michael Smirkanish, Brian Kilmeade on Fox News this morning, you know, treating the speech, you know, as historic? Does that make the rock throwing through other conservative bloggers seem much more small minded and petty?
No, I mean it only motivates them further. I mean, I think you could say, you know, does it? First you have to ask, you know, was the speech a success? And you know, I guess. We'll only find out through polling at the time, but, you know, so far what we've seen is Obama definitely has a tall mountain to climb on that shit. But as far as stopping his bleeding among the liberal elite press, it definitely solved that. Because what you had going into the speech is that Barack Obama was facing two major threats to the very core of his candidacy. Number one on judgment, and number two on honesty, and that his whole line throughout controversy was brewing was that, you know, Reverend Wright was a crazy uncle, that Barack Obama had never heard him utter anything controversial while he was there, and all these kind of speeches just to kind of minimize it. And it became obvious, you know, after the Anderson Cooper interviews, and he even went on Fox News in interviews, that the line that he had never heard Jeremiah Wright utter anything controversial, that line was just not going to pass.
That's not quite what he said. He didn't say he'd never heard anything controversial. That's not what Obama said on those shows.
He said he'd never heard those controversial statements, which, again, is deliberately...
Those particular statements, that degree of incendiariness, that's what he said.
Right, which is deliberately vague and, you know, slippery to get around it. So he is threatening a major attack on his credibility, which has already been building off of the fact that he tells the American people one thing and Samantha Powers is telling Europe something else. He tells America one thing and then Arthur Goolsbee is going to Canada and telling them something else on NAFTA. So he's facing a major threat on his honesty front. The second major threat he's facing with the Reverend Wright's incident is on judgment. The line that, you know, that Chris Matthews and the other ones put out is, you know, why did he sit in the pews all these years and listen to this stuff and not confront the pastor? But, you know, I would ask a much different question, is that, you know, by Barack's own admissions, you know, Reverend Wright has, quote, a distorted view of this country and is, quote, not only wrong but divisive. So if Obama knew that you know, Reverend Wright was distorted, wrong, and divisive, then why is Obama appointing him to his committee on African-American religious leadership? To his campaign. So that goes to his core about judgment, because he wants to make this, you know, campaign about Hillary Clinton's judgment. And now we have seen that a man who's running to be president, who will have power to appoint people to the Civil Rights Commission, to the Justice Department, to the Supreme Court, is appointing someone like Reverend Wright, someone he knows has distorted, wrong, divisive judgment, to his own campaign committee on religious leadership. So facing those two threats, Reverend Obama goes in and basically, you know, plays the race card. and does it masterfully and beautifully. And, you know, Chris Matthews called it the greatest speech, you know, of all time. All the liberal commentators have loved it. He's gotten, you know, great.
Do me a favor.
Yes.
Define what you mean by playing the race card.
He took an issue that was about his judgment and his honesty and made it instead about race in America.
I mean, I don't think that is what most people would think when they hear playing the race card.
Well, I mean, you know, Obama brought up, OJ in his speech, and exactly what Johnny Cochran did. We had an issue that was about whether or not, you know, OJ, you know, was guilty, and all of a sudden it became about whether or not the LA Police Department was racist. Well, this was an issue about Barack Obama's judgment and his honesty, and instead it became about America's racism. He beautifully changed the subject. The speech was tactically brilliant. It changed the subject from judgment and honesty to American racism.
To go back to what you said originally, you said questions were raised. Why someone who was basing his campaign on unity would have someone who has said divisive things be on his committee? The speech directly answered that question. It's not a changing of the subject. It's answering that exact question.
No. You're not true. Reverend Wright is no longer on his committee.
But you're asking why he was on there in the first place. Why has he had this relationship with the church? Why is he a spiritual advisor?
Yeah, that's not the question I asked. The question is about his judgment about making this man a part of his committee. At one point, Obama believed that this man should be part of his committee and he should be featured prominently on his website. Then Barack Obama, after this controversy began, took him off the committee and scrubbed him from his website. Now, you know, I don't have a pastor. I've never had a relationship with a priest, a pastor, a rabbi, anything like that. So I have no expertise at all to say, you know, whether or not Obama should or should not have a relationship with this guy, you know, as his the leader of his congregation. I don't know. I do follow politics a lot. And I know that when you choose to make someone, you know, a member of your campaign and feature them prominently on your website, that does talk about your judgment. And when he admits that this person has wrong and divisive views but still makes him part of this campaign, that talks about his judgment. He changed it from that to an issue of race. Now,
he stepped down from the committee. We don't know exactly if he was pushed or if he jumped on his own. That's never really been explained.
Obama definitely scrubbed him from his website. Reverend Wright didn't break into the Obama website and remove himself.
Hold on, once. I mean, he stepped down, and so you do what you do after that. That happened after, according to Obama, he had learned about things that he had not been aware of before that were particularly incendiary. But then the question remained, that didn't end the question because he still had this very long relationship with him and the church. What could that possibly mean? That raised a whole host of questions. He answered those questions by talking about the anger and the bitterness and resentment that exists not only amongst the black community, but also in the white community. And so he expanded the issue, because to just talk about one slice of the issue is not treating the issue appropriately. And I think the vast majority of Americans that saw that speech or read the speech and heard the commentary afterwards understood that. And that's why it's not being treated as just a crude tactical move. It's being treated as an historic speech because it's been so rare that we can talk about these issues in its complete holistic sense and not reduced to a lot of cheap sound bites where people do play the race card and don't actually address underlying problems.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, would be the second major critique that many people on the conservative side have been saying. Where I first saw it, I think it was first on the Wall Street Journal, but where I first saw the line was on a power long by Scott Johnson, called the speech the Throw Grandma Under the Bus speech,
which
I thought was so great.
Absolutely.
No,
that
because
is,
that's exactly,
that is,
that's exactly
that is,
what the core
it's insulting
of the speech
to him,
was.
It's insulting to him. It's insulting to his grandmother. It is cherry-picking what he said. And Brian Kilmeade, you know, God bless Brian Kilmeade for calling that out for what it is on Fox and Friends this morning.
I don't watch Fox and Friends. I'm a Morning Joe guy.
I have not been a Fox and Friends fan until today. Now I am a devoted Brian Kilmeade fan.
What did Brian Kilmeade say exactly?
Because they were talking about this issue. So Obama was on, you know, Philadelphia Sports Talk Station.
Yes.
I think yesterday.
It was yesterday.
And was talking about that aspect of the speech where he said, I cannot He was talking about, you know, the anger and bitterness in the black community that you see in some of Reverend Wright's sermons. They said to disown him would be disowning the black community, just as it would be disowning my, my white grandmother, who has said, talked to me about how uncomfortable she is sometimes when she sees a black person across the street. It makes me cringe. He was trying to show that these things are part of society. They're on both sides, that he's seen them in his personal experiences, and therefore he embraces the good and the bad of all of this. And talking about in more detail on this radio station, he says that he wasn't saying that his grandmother has some a particularly high degree of racial animosity, but she's a typical white person. And
there
that,
you go.
A typical white person is the phrase that he used. And that this this produced a wave of what I would call conservative correctness. Oh, he said typical white person. Well, what if Hillary said typical black person? Everyone would go ballistic, but he's Barack Obama, and he's the Messiah, so no one's going to say anything. But it's not as if he said all white people are racist, or he said all black people are lazy. That's not what he's saying at all. And he went on to elaborate further in a later statement to make sure there was no misunderstanding. And Brian, and this was brought up on Fox and Friends Friday morning. It was Brian Kilmeade. This is a guy who was hyping that Obama was in a madrasa last year. But to give Brian Kilmeade full credit, heard the speech, listened to the whole thing, listened to the full statement afterwards, said he was not making a hyper-racial comment here. He was talking about something that is just patently obvious, that there are things that are inbred in you, the way we are socialized, that no matter how much we want to overcome it, we can't do it completely all the time. So, you know, Brian Kilmeade gets it. A lot of other people get it. And when you try to cherry-pick it out to try to make an issue of it, I think the way this is playing out, it's the conservative blogosphere, they're going to look very small in the end of all this.
Yeah, you jumped ahead to the typical white person comment. I was going to save that for later. I was the throw grandma under the bus speech line came much before those statements.
That's because
at the core of Obama's speech, not cherry picking, the core of his speech is a moral equivalence between the bile that comes out of Pastor Wright's mouth, which, you know, Barack Obama says is divisive and wrong and all that other stuff, a moral equivalence between that and Barack Obama's grandmother. That is what is wrong in the speech, is because, you know, you say he answered all the questions, but I still don't know. When Barack Obama wants us to have a question about race, you know, are Reverend Wright's comments, are they part of the mainstream that we should be addressing, and that they should be part of religious committees that are talked about in respectable ways? Or, as Barack Obama also says, are they to be condemned and separated from? Because Barack Obama still condemns these statements. Barack Obama still has him removed him from the committee, right? Barack Obama still has removed him from his campaign. So which is it? Is he the same as his grandmother, and are Reverend Wright's statements part of the mainstream that we should be talking about in this conversation of race, or are they not? I have a call coming in.
You have a call coming in?
No, it stopped. After reading this speech three or four times, I still don't know what the answer to that question is. Do you?
Is it mainstream, or is
it something we're condemning? I don't know. And so that's the moral equivalence at the core of the grandma comparison.
I don't think it's very hard to figure out. The things that were shown on YouTube in recent days are things that Obama has, those statements he has condemned. He's saying explicitly, I can condemn the statements and not condemn the man, because I know the man, I know his life work, and I know what he has done for me spiritually, and I can say that just because he has said some things that I find divisive and hurtful doesn't mean that he as an individual is a bad person. And the equivalence there is that I've heard hurtful things from my white grandmother, but I know she loves me, I know she's not a racist, and I know that she is a good person too, and I'm not going to cut myself off from her. I don't see what's so hard to understand here.
Well, I'm not asking Barack Obama to, you know, condemn Reverend Wright. I don't even know if he has you know, the power to condemn his soul or ever. I'm questioning his judgment on making him a part of his campaign.
You keep saying that
the revelations of these YouTubes is something brand new to Obama, but that goes back to the credibility problem, is that you know, the underlying theology of this church is not a surprise to anyone. And, you know, Sean Hannity had a confrontation with Pastor Wright last year, in which, you know, Pastor Wright went on to defend one of the founders of the church's theology, this Joseph Cohn guy, who wrote, you know, Black Theology and Black Power, a book that, you know, says that Marxism works well with Christianity and that America is the Antichrist because it supported slavery and segregation. This is the foundation of the church. You know, Obama may have not seen those comments, but he knew the underlying theology. And so the question is, you know, are these statements, should they be part of the mainstream? Are they part of bringing unity to America? Or are they things that need to be addressed, pointed out to be wrong, and should not be part of someone's campaign committee on religious leadership?
Well, to answer your question about political judgment, I'm sure that in the conventional wisdom of politics, you know, you wouldn't be part of that church, you wouldn't have this guy on your committee, you'd try to do everything as strictly middle of the road and mainstream as possible, and you don't get in any trouble. What is potentially transforming about the speech is it is directly talking to the media.
Talking to the media. I agree with you there. The speech was totally geared towards the media.
Well, that's
to change
what,
the conversation
one audience.
From
one,
the, his there's, judgment there's, and his honesty back to a question of race.
There's one. The media is one audience of the speech. It's not the entirety of his audience, but there is a piece in that speech that is definitely directed towards the media, and is saying, you know, we can treat. It's the OJ piece. Do you want to treat this as spectacle, or do you actually want to talk about the underlying issue?
Yeah, he was definitely shaming the media there. No doubt about it.
And if he is successful in doing that,
and so far he has been,
you know, that changes how we practice politics from this point forward. Where having someone on your ceremonial committee who has said something at some time that someone's not going to like is not the end-all be-all of who you are as a candidate. It ends the whole guilt by association attack line. So it may end up being that the way he's handling this in some is going to be one of the most politically brilliant exercise of judgment that we've seen in the last 40 years. We'll see how it plays out.
Does this mean the politics in New Unity includes the Reverend Wrights of the world being appointed to the Civil Rights Committee, being appointed to the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department? Are those views now going to be part of the U.S. government? Is that the New Unity that Barack Obama is bringing?
No.
But his judgment says that this guy is part of the mainstream and should be on his campaign.
You're making tons of logical jumps here. He's not saying that everything that Jeremiah Wright has ever uttered is to be fully embraced by the policies of the United States government. That is not what he's saying. He is saying that there's been anger and bitterness about and racial wounds all across the board. They sometimes surface in unseemly ways, and if we don't shine a light on that and acknowledge that and realize that we all have these issues, but we all have things that tie us together in common as well, we're never going to get past this stuff. That doesn't automatically lead to, let's have Marxist black liberation theology be enshrined in our U.S. Constitution. It's not the same thing.
But if we're going to be having that conversation, our leaders need to be bringing people into the conversation that have messages and have the temperament and have the judgment to have the conversation in a way that unifies us. And what strings credulity is that Obama had no idea that Jeremiah Wright said things that might be controversial or that might make him a bad choice for his leadership committee.
Well, what it comes down to is, you know, how big is your tent here? You know, Barack Obama spoke to Rich Warren's church. Rich Warren is a conservative pastor. Barack Obama doesn't agree with everything that Rich Warren has ever said.
But they agree on global warming.
They agree on global warming. They don't agree on abortion. Does that mean that everything that Rich Warren believes is going to be enshrined in the U.S. Constitution? Now Barack Obama hates abortion, is going to repeal Roe v. Wade because he went to Rich Warren's church? No. Yes, everything that Reverend Hagee says and Reverend Parsley says, John McCain's spiritual advisor. Does John McCain now say that this is a war against Islam because Parsley's his spiritual advisor? Do you want to say that? Am I to presume that Parsley's going to be in John McCain's cabinet now?
John McCain never gave John Hagee $22,000.
He solicited Hagee's endorsement. Parsley is his own words, his spiritual advisor, which is the same way that Obama would talk to Wright. The money that Barack Obama gave to his church, his congregation, is not being used in divisive ways. It's being used for good social works. So I don't see what the point is there. So you tell me, am I now assume that every religious figure that McCain is in league with, I'm to assume that he's going to be in his cabinet? Now, I don't assume that.
Some more than others. If John McCain, you know, has a, you know, religious leadership committee, and he appoints, if he did appoint, you know, Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell to it, yes, I would very much expect to see the cable news networks covering it and bringing up Pat Robertson's comments on 9/11
and bringing up Jerry Falwell's comments on Parsley and Hagee right here. We have individuals.
Hagee has nothing to do with the John McCain campaign.
John McCain solicited his endorsement. He went out of his way to get his endorsement.
There's a difference between an endorsement and making someone part of your campaign. And
what's it? There's no difference at all.
To conflate, you know, McCain's.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we can just, you know, leave it to the American people, you know, who they believe has a stronger relationship, John McCain and John Hagee or Barack Obama and his pastor. I think it's pretty clear.
If that's true, the way that Obama has explained that relationship and put it in context, I believe most Americans are going to accept. Because everyone's going to see what Barack Obama believes himself, what he's going to bring to the U.S. government, and why he has the spiritual relationships that he does.
Yeah, it's possible, but when they're then trying to see what Barack Obama actually believes, they're going to see comments like his grandma is a typical white person, and they're going to have trouble with that.
Listen to a Sean Hannity, which most Americans don't, thankfully.
So we'll see how well he goes on it. I mean, the early numbers aren't looking good, especially among independents.
All the numbers that we've seen so far are all pre-speech.
That's true. I guess we'll find out over the weekend how much effect the speech had. Moving on from Obama to Hillary. Who also did not have a very good week.
As Chuck Todd said on First Read, nobody had a good week.
Nobody had a good week. Although I don't think she lost a lot this week. I mean, she did lose Jennifer Granholm, Michigan delegation said, or Michigan governor, but basically said there's no way there's a revote happening in Michigan. Similar news out of Florida. Without Michigan and Florida, even with Michigan and Florida, there was next to zero chance that Clinton would be able to overtake Obama in the delegate lead. But without Michigan and Florida, the more important thing is it's next to impossible now for her to overtake him in the popular vote lead, which was going to be her last best effort to muddy the will of the people thing before going to the super delegates to say, you know, you guys should come over to me.
So I got to say, I think the popular vote bar is, in this case, a meaningless number, because you can't add up numbers from primaries along with caucuses.
It's not a great argument, but it's one of the better ones they had, and they're going to be in a lot weaker position without it.
That I assume is true.
Moving on, I guess, I mean, after talking about Obama and Wright, a lot of the talk going on is, what is the end game for Hillary here? How does Obama get her out of the race at this point? Or does this go all the way to the convention?
Well, I think it's increasingly clear the superdelegates do not want to go all the way to the convention. It may be unavoidable to have it not go until June, but no one wants an entire summer without knowing who the nominee is going to be. They can't build up campaign staff. They can't really raise money. Everyone's sort of paralyzed. I don't think anybody wants that. And so if there's 20 degree that the superdelegates can get their act together, as one superdelegate floated in the New York Times this week, that they can have some sort of mini convention early so they can make their votes known. I assume they're going to do that. I'm sure the Clintons would very much have liked to have a popular vote number they could wave around. But in the end, what they're trying to do, or the only hope that they have, is to say it doesn't matter what the elected delegate total is, Obama can't win for one reason or another, and hoping that stories like the right story, hoping that those weigh him down. Where the superdelegates would say, hey, he got the most delegates, but I'm not going to be on a suicide mission here. If he's polling 10 points down versus McCain and Clinton's polling 10 points up, we're going to go with Clinton. And Florida and Michigan are semi-irrelevant to that. The harder thing for Clinton is for people to believe that Obama can't win. And every time they think they kind of got this guy on the ropes, he pulls off, you know, a real masterstroke. Again, we'll see how the speech plays out. You know, they thought they had him on the ropes with the VP stuff, and Obama turned that back around on him.
The what stuff?
The trying to treat him as a VP candidate, as number two.
Diminishing. I don't think they thought they had him on that.
Well, he seemed a little...
It was another piece of the kitchen thing to throw out there. I don't think they thought it was a silver bullet.
No, but there's been all sorts of kitchen sink things that have gone at him, and most of the time, even if Obama's been unsteady for a few days with it, he tends to find his footing and turn it back around. And I think it's going to apply again in the case of Wright in the speech. So they have had a difficult time, taking him out fundamentally to the point where people say, well, he won some contests before, but
I'm asking a different question. You keep talking about the Clintons trying to take him out. I think it's more of an issue of she's been on the ropes for a good, month and a half now.
Why can't he
land that right cross and send her to the mat?
Well, that's an interesting dynamic, and that's because there is a reservoir of Clinton love and brand loyalty within the Democratic Party that makes it very hard to knock her out altogether. She is rare. Her expectations bar, I've said this before, her expectations bar can be set on the ground, and she doesn't hemorrhage support because there are Democrats that just love Clintons. And there are other people that have been very invested.
Although they love him a lot less these days.
For a long time. So that's a hard thing to wrench away. So I don't think that it really speaks to a weakness in Obama's candidacy. It's amazing he's been able to take it this far and be in the lead against someone who has had a deep reservoir of support in the party.
No, I don't think it's a weakness of the Obama candidacy. I think it's more a testament to Clinton's strength and endurance. It's not the word I was looking for. But, what I was trying to say is that I agree that this is not going to the convention, that the superdelegates will step in well before then. The question is how soon. We were talking about the Pastor Wright situation earlier. I think early next week, the polls that come out are going to be very, very important, because if it shows Obama bleeding support, I think you will see more talk of Michigan and Florida reviving. However, if Obama recovers or stays in the same spot, I think you're going to see Michigan and Florida stay dead. I think you're going to see Hillary Clinton win by 10, 15 in Pennsylvania, Barack Obama win North Carolina, and after Obama wins North Carolina and pretty much locks up the delegate lead, I think you will see the super delegates get together and talk about do what you were talking about before, our caucus, and wrap this thing up well before the convention, because I don't think anyone on the Democratic side wants to see this bleeding continue. So as soon as it's clear that Obama is viable and has patched up this Reverend Wright mess, stopped this bleeding, I think you will see Florida and Michigan shut down. Everyone will go ahead and let Hillary take a shot in Pennsylvania, but it will wrap up very quickly after that. However, if you see him bleeding on Wright, and if you see Michigan revived, and if you see Florida revived, and Obama giving into new contests in those states, then I think it's highly likely that Hillary will take this to convention. So up to now, I think it has been about Hillary's stick-to-itiveness, but going from here, I think you're going to see the polls coming out next week be very important to determining how much longer this gets played out.
Well, it's definitely, I think, a huge desire. I actually thought the desire was even deeper. I thought Obama was going to win at least Texas because Democratic voters would not want this to go to the convention. And if you like them both, vote for the person in the lead and avoid having this massive calamity. And so I was a little surprised that it's going on this long.
To be perfectly honest, I was rooting for Obama in Texas and Ohio because I wanted the primary to be over. I thought it was like watching a terminal patient die, and I was rooting for the end. But now I'm just enjoying the show, so I've changed my mind.
But definitely that sense remains within the party establishment. No one wants us to drag out. But at the same time, Obama is the fresh face. There is a desire to see how he handles political crises like this. That's why you don't see all the superdelegates, bum rushing to him immediately, because they kind of want to see it play out, see how he holds up. I think everyone was very intrigued, at minimum, by how he handled this particular crisis. Because it obviously was not out of the political playbook 101.
Yeah, this is as closest as any candidate can get to the 3 a.m. phone call. I mean, which of course is mythical and silly, but this is the presidential 3 a.m. phone call. This is Obama getting tested.
Right. So, I could still see this even if Clinton wins Pennsylvania, and Obama wins North Carolina, which is sort of the predictable outcome at this point. I could still see superdelegates wanting to let it play out through June. The logic we've taken it this far.
It depends how close North Carolina is and how bad the Pennsylvania loss is for Obama.
Everyone's going to weigh those sorts of factors. But even if there's a sense that Obama has the clear delegate lead and it's not going away, I still might suspect it plays out through the last primary just to see, does anything else pop up that we weren't aware of? How does he handle that? And then in late June, early July, maybe you'll see superdelegates do something in a cohesive fashion, although it's certainly been remarked, I think, in a couple of corners that superdelegates are quote-unquote cowards who aren't necessarily interested in sticking their necks out one way or the other. But I think the fear of a divided convention it ends up being paramount. Seeing how Obama handles these things is still, I think, in the back of a lot of people's minds. And I think there's general support of how he's handled these things to date. But the bottom line is, of course, the voters.
Yeah, I mean, if he jumps up in Pennsylvania and Ohio and those numbers turn around and he gains and people rally to his speech, I think it's going to be over for Clinton in short order. If he continues to bleed, this is going to go on.
Have you been noticing his recent media tour of the sports talk stations?
You know what? I have. I have always been a big fan of sports talk. I grew up on KNBR 68, the sports leader, out in San Francisco. And when I go home, I still listen to the Ticket 1050, and I listen to 980 Sports Talk here in D.C., although it's not nearly as good as my hometown stations. So I'm a big fan. I think it's a great strategy. He pulls it off well. It's not surprising, though. I remember way back, I think we've actually talked about this before, Obama called into NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, he didn't call into it, but there was a segment on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me about how Obama had dressed down a reporter, a college reporter, from a newspaper, and the college reporter had then written a story about it and how Obama had ruined his game with this young female college reporter that was at the same press conference, and Obama called the guy up on his cell phone and apologized, it was very natural, showed Obama was hip and with it, and he was very, very, very smooth, and Obama has a history of being able to communicate, on this level. He plays basketball, he's a big sports fan, so it's a natural thing for him. It's a great strategy.
And before we wrap up, we probably should give a little bit more attention to John McCain this week.
Yes.
He had a gaffe of his own. He is trying to emphasize his foreign policy experience, yet he, by his own admission, mixed up who, in his opinion, Iran is supporting in the multifaceted Iraq Civil War.
And then to make it a Netroots absolute banana split home run, it was Joe Lieberman who had to tap him on the shoulder and say, you meant to say, you didn't mean to say Al-Qaeda there.
It was especially hilarious.
Yes.
Although their
Joe Lieberman of all people.
But the McCain's attempts to pawn it off as an isolated slip-up got exposed when I think some blogs and also Keith Olbermann had flagged that he had made this comment on several occasions. Barack Obama sought to take advantage of this. There's definitely, I think, a huge appetite in Democratic circles to turn fire on McCain whenever possible, and Obama is trying to show he can do that. He gets squeezed up by other things often. And so I guess my question to you is, to what obviously McCain has not been dinged too badly in public perception because it hasn't really been seen as much. The spotlight's not on him as much right now, even when he makes these gaffes. Is there any sense on the conservative side that even if it's like he's getting hit with it right now, this doesn't bode well going forward?
Let me say this. No one's worried about John McCain's knowledge of the situation in Iraq. If you watch the cable news networks, you'll see the Andrew Mitchells, John Kings, Wolf Blitzers of the world say they talked to John McCain. They know John McCain knows his issues backwards and forwards. Conservatives are not worried about a name starting that John McCain doesn't know what's going on in the Middle East. What I don't know how widespread this is in the conservative movement, but what I have always been worried about is the portrayal of John McCain as maybe being a little old. And that was what conservative bloggers said when this first came out, is that, he was very tired, he hadn't had sleep for 48 hours, it was just a mix of the tongue. Which, it is a good excuse one time. But when you have David Letterman running a segment every night, instead of having his, greatest presidential speeches ever where he makes Bush look stupid, and he's replacing that with John McCain's old clips every night, Jay Leno is making John McCain's old jokes every night. I think that is going to be a big issue in the general election, to have a young, vibrant, fiercely intelligent Barack Obama versus a patriotic war hero, but, perhaps maybe a little bit old John McCain. That's going to be definitely reinforced in the mainstream media, and that's what I think it's sort of thing to worry about.
When you say mainstream media, you're expanding that to go into the pop culture realm, not necessarily the Andrew Mitchells of the world.
Right. Well, we all know that. We all know that most people get their news from The Daily Show and Saturday Night Live and Jay Leno. So they are part of the mainstream media. I don't think you're going to see them saying that John McCain doesn't know what's going on in Iraq. Mostly because they don't believe that's true, and neither do the cable news people. However, I do think you're going to see people saying that he's not young.
And I think you did want to make one comment before we finish about one of your favorite bloggers, Andrew Sullivan.
Yes. My good friend Andrew had a post earlier this week where basically he said if you did not think Barack Obama's speech was the best thing since the Gettysburg Address, you're basically a racist. And I thought Ross Doubt That's, reply that, no, it's not that, we're all racists all of a sudden, Andrew. It's that Barack Obama's solution to racism in America is big government programs that conservatives are against and that you were once against, but not so much anymore. So I would just say that my good friend Andrew Sullivan has gone cuckoo for Obama puffs, and I don't know if we'll ever get him back.
Well, Andrew Sullivan once called folks like me part of a fifth column in America, so I'm no Andrew Sullivan fan, regardless of which way he decides to blow, this week.
Well, I guess you can be the fifth column, and I can be a racist, and we can hang out together and be friends, Bill.
But I would say that if you're gonna criticize the speech, criticize the speech itself, and I've seen other conservative commentators say this. Well, where Barack Obama ends is just same old liberal boilerplate. So this is not as new and interesting as it's cracked up to be. But let's not ignore that he criticized busing.
Yeah, but not really. I mean, see, we can get back into that if you really want to. But he didn't really criticize busing. He says he understands why it made people angry. I don't know if he's against busing or not.
What's
he
a also, fair point?
He also said that affirmative action causes anger. We still don't know if he reads about if he is for or against affirmative action or not. Again, that's why when everyone says the speech was so honest, I have to disagree, because it left so many questions unanswered. What is his position on busing? What is his position on affirmative action?
Well, so those are totally fair questions. It's actually quite stunning that he's not been asked.
No, not really, because, you know, he talks about race in America. So, you know, everyone thinks that's great, and he was honest, and isn't he wonderful? And, you know, he's the second coming. This is the greatest speech in the Gettysburg Address. And, you know, let's not examine the real questions that he didn't answer. The only mainstream source that I really think raises question is Brian Ross at ABC, and I'll include that blog post, which is funny because it was Brian Ross's piece on Good Morning America that brought this whole controversy into the mainstream. I mean, these videos have been out there for a long time. It wasn't until that piece was on Good Morning America and then got picked up by Jay Leno that night that this scandal took off.
It's totally appropriate to follow up with Obama and say, hey, can you flesh out your opinion on affirmative action? That is totally appropriate.
Well, we know he's for it.
Well,
we know he's for affirmative action.
I'm sorry?
We know he's for affirmative action.
But my guess is that it's not going to be a simple yes or no answer, but it's a complicated issue.
Well, I guarantee you it's not going to be a simple yes or no answer, because Brock doesn't give simple yes or no answers.
And that is why people have been impressed with the speech, that he's saying, look, these things don't always have cut and dry answers. There's a lot of complexity to them, and it's okay to talk about that. The kind of thing that made John Kerry seem French and got him laughed at a lot. It's the kind of thing that's making Barack Obama seem very presidential.
Yeah, sometimes yes or no questions can be clarifying and helpful, and complexity can be deceptive.
And I have noticed in a lot of conservative commentary the use of the word clever in reference to Obama's speech to imply there's disingenuity there.
I didn't say clever. I said tactically
brilliant. You did not. But I have seen that elsewhere. And I think there's a lot of intent behind those sorts of words. But I think it's worth pointing out that there was a number of lines in there. I mean, he talked about specifically support of the conservative notions of self-help and personal responsibility. He at least allowed the legitimacy of criticism towards certain affirmative action practices and busing.
Did he though? I mean,
he did.
He said that, you know, he understands that anger and that criticism, but then he equated it with Reverend Wright's controversial statements, which we also know he condemned. So did he legitimize that anger, or did he condemn it?
I think my read of the speech is, he said that the frustrations are legitimate and real. And very explicitly about crime. He was basically saying that white Americans should not be treated as racist if they are upset about crime. He was very explicit about that. So you're making sort of a diagonal line and not a straight line there. You know, he's not saying that Jeremiah Wright's comments are acceptable. He's saying there's underlying frustration and resentment that's real. And he's saying there's underlying frustration and resentment with whites that is real also. And for good reason, because of the way affirmative action has been carried out in some instances, the way busing has been carried out, and issues of crime. That's not to equate that with racially divisive comments that we heard from Jeremiah Wright. Everyone's got free speech. Everyone's got free thought. If there's things you don't like about the speech, say so. Make a reasoned criticism, but criticize the full speech and don't cherry pick out certain lines of the speech and ignore others.
Well, whenever you discuss a speech, you have to cite what parts of the speech you're talking about, which involves redacting the rest of the, you know, 45-minute, 30-minute speech. So you have to cherry pick. Otherwise, you can't discuss it.
We'll leave it there, I suppose.
Sounds good. I'm glad we were able to have a civil discussion without calling each other racist or traitors to the nation.
Excellent.
Okay. Talk to you in 2 weeks, Phil.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye.